Welcome to World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C. And we have a number of big stories to cover for you this week. We're going to get, we hope, another legal update from Phil Berg. We have some interesting news on the publication front, not least of all the continued availability of Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide through the worst financial crisis in human history. Buy it from progressivepress.com or from amazon.com. The general framework for our comments this week is the turn of the tide on Obama. Obama has peaked. Obama has now entered into the inevitable process of cratering, just as we saw with Jimmy Carter, the previous model of the trilateral Wall Street-controlled puppet president. Carter peaked, of course, as I write in Obama the Postmodern Coup, which you can also get from Amazon.com. In Obama the Postmodern Coup, I draw an extensive parallel between Carter and Obama. And this is basically a prediction made last February, March, published in April of last year, before the Pennsylvania primary. Carter peaked in April, May of 1977, his first year in office. And sure enough, the trilateral pedigree, the banker-controlled, Wall Street-dictated, hedge fund hyena-favoring policies that Carter had, maybe not hedge funds at that time, but the other parts apply, these things are now dragging Obama down. And Obama has now, I believe, passed the peak of his charismatic, messianic popularity. And it goes fast. It goes fast, of course, because when you want to get a trilateral puppet elected, you've got to be very vague, because you can't say what you're really going to do, and it's probably not advisable to lie diametrically from what you're going to do, although, of course, they do that too. But the best way to do it is to keep it vague. You run on hope and change. You present the tabula rasa, the blank slate, and every chump and sucker and dupe and gull and cretin is able to project onto that blank slate anything that they understand under hope and change. Then you get into office. Larry Summers comes in, Geithner comes in, Volcker comes in, the rest of them come in, Susan Rice, and so forth, and they begin then to fill in the blanks, and of course then people are appalled. So this is the method now that is overtaking Obama. Note well, it is not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning, the turn of the tide, the possibility of blocking Obama's legislative agenda and inducing gridlock between a bankrupt administration and an equally bankrupt Republican opposition. We can debate which one is more bankrupt intellectually and morally, but both are intellectually and morally insane. Therefore, the best we can get out of this situation is gridlock. Dr. Gridlock is the best ally we have. Block virtually everything. Force an in-depth discussion. What caused the depression? How do you get out of a depression? Can we use these childish slogans like free markets and anti-big government? Is that going to get you out of the depression? The Herbert Hoover Coolidge experience tells us no. Neither, of course, can we rely on the Mussolini fascist corporate state as practiced by Obama. So therefore, a prolonged, protracted debate in the crucible of the depression to clarify people's ideas about what economic policy ought to be. And certainly as Obama fails, his nostrums will lose popularity. But as these Republican free market demagogues, free market being a slogan used by the Republican Party when it's out of power in order to take power and then begin more corruption, more direct transfers of wealth to their constituencies, this free market demagogy, the Austrian school hokum, this is also discredited because, of course, the Austrian school, with its insistence on an immediate deflationary crash and therefore liquidate stocks, liquidate bonds, liquidate real estate, liquidate labor, liquidate everybody, liquidate you, but not the rich. That Austrian school stuff, as pronounced famously by Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of the Treasury back in the 1920s, under whom Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover served. That stuff loses its appeal as soon as people are on a breadline, as soon as you're getting unemployment, as soon as your life depends on food stamps, as soon as you need government help to stop a predator from coming in and foreclosing on your house and throwing your family out on the street. All of that Austrian garbage vanishes like dreams at dawn because it goes away. It's a chimera. It goes glimmering into the land of things that never were and never will be. And at that point, in that sober, bleak world of the dawn, maybe there's a chance for a reality-based economics and a reality-based politics. Not monetarist, not coming from David Ricardo of the East India Company, by way of the Austrian school, Friedman, Hayek, von Mises, and then the Republicans, be they Herbert Hoover or, better yet, Goldwater. And not Malthusian, not coming from Thomas Malthus, who ran the management training school for the British East India Company. So let's stay away, via Keynes then, into the modern world. Let's stay away from both branches of the British East India Company economic schools. No to monetarism, no to Malthusianism. That would mean the green slime, the gangrene economy of cap and trade and the carbon tax and so forth. And we also want to say preemptively, no to mexophobia, because once all else fails, the ruling elite will attempt to blame wetbacks. They'll attempt to blame penniless, terrified, super-exploited Mexican labor. And they'll say that the fact that some of these people got subprime mortgages was what brought down the entire imperialist banking system. Quite a fantastic story. So this is where we are now. The polling, the stories on a number of news stories, news broadcasts this week, towards the middle of the week, we have a poll issued by NBC News and the Wall Street Journal. And they show that Obama, within a period of a month, just about at the same time as Carter, give or take a few weeks, that Obama has gone from 61% approval to 56% approval, and that within a very short time, and that his standing among independents, those fussy independents that we're supposed to be so concerned about, which, of course, are a voting bloc of some importance, those independents, they've gone down on Obama by about 14 or 15%. So those are serious losses for Obama. Now, the only thing you want to remember then about Carter is that, as a general rule, Carter peaked at the end of the 100 days, a little bit beyond the end of the 100 days, say in April, May, and then into June, where we are now. But Carter also then got a big bump. He got a big uptick at the taking of the Iranian hostages, which was connived in by the U.S. intelligence community. Remember the infamous meeting of Zbigniew Brzezinski, Robert Gates, current boss of the Pentagon, with Iranian Prime Minister Bazargan, Foreign Minister Yazdi, people who are Yazdi now back in the news for various reasons. They met in Algiers in November of 1979 and talked about the continuation of U.S. military deliveries to Iran, what later became known as Iran-Contra. And those deliveries never stopped. And the intel word is that in that meeting, the taking of the hostages was connived in and arranged. And that gave Carter an uptick, but then it also gave him a downtick. So watch out now. The door to false flag operations is wide open under the telegenic Obama. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Duff here in Washington, D.C., talking about the turn of the tide vis-a-vis Obama. And naturally, this owes nothing to the right-wing reactionary ranting of the Limbaughs, the Cheneys, the Hannitys, the Newt Gingriches, these characters. You notice the Obama White House remains eager to play itself off against these odious figures. George Bush the Younger has poked his nose out of the cerements of his forgotten mausoleum this week to opine. The Obama White House is just delighted. They couldn't get enough of it. They're probably going to fund a road show of these odious reactionary figures that I've just mentioned, because that's what helps them. And let's get this straight again. You call Obama a socialist? You're helping him. It's a gift. You say that he's concerned about the poor? That's wonderful cover for Obama, who doesn't give a damn about the poor. You say that the unions have power under Obama? The UAW has been destroyed. The UAW has lost all their wages, all their benefits, and their health care in the future has been exchanged for worthless stock in General Motors and Chrysler. Open your eyes. Throw off the goggles of your idiotic right-wing ideology. Look at what is actually happening. Obama is a Wall Street puppet. This is the opposite of socialism. This has nothing to do with concern about the poor. And the unions are getting shafted six ways to Sunday. The UAW caused to vote itself out of existence when Obama cynically drove General Motors and Chrysler into bankruptcy. And $6 billion was immediately transferred to Wall Street. Wall Street made out like a bandit, paid in cash. $6 billion, as Greg Palast pointed out in a useful article. $6 billion went from this auto complex immediately to the coffers of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. But that was the health care fund. The health care fund was in effect, and pension fund was robbed. The cash went immediately to the Wall Street banks. And now those UAW guys are sitting there with pieces of paper that say General Motors and Chrysler stock. And the value of that is anybody's guess. But my guess is that it's a wasting asset, because these companies have been delivered into the hands of asset strippers. And the attempt to build plug-in electric cars is technologically unfeasible. And therefore, this is a doomed enterprise. So Obama represents Wall Street, Wall Street, Wall Street. Government of the bankers, by the bankers, for the bankers. Stop with the socialism already. Polls have now found that socialism, for many people, has a vaguely benign or beneficent overtone, right? Communism is long gone. No Soviets for the past 20 years, almost. And therefore, socialism is not going to scare anybody. As a matter of fact, after 8 years of the depredations of Mad Dog Bush and his reactionary Republican gang, to a lot of people, socialism sounds like, well, let's give that a try. Couldn't be worse than Bush. So you call Obama a socialist, you're giving him a gift. When you call him a socialist, I want to know, is he paying you to say that? Because if you're not getting paid, you're providing services for nothing. The operative term here is fascism. The fascist corporate state, the Mussolini fascist corporate state, a government-sponsored compulsory cartel in which wages are driven down. See Detroit, wages driven down. Production is cut. See Detroit, production is cut. And fictitious, bloated, cancerous derivatives and other forms of paper capital are propped up. Same thing. See Detroit. The $6 billion went to Wall Street at the same time that the UAW was looted. That's the corporate state. That's the Mussolini fascist corporate state, Italy, 1930 to 1940, the mature form of the Mussolini regime when he got to do what he wanted to do. The corporate means that you've got government presiding over a tripartite arrangement with management and labor in which the values of the banks predominate, certainly not the value of labor. The union is transformed into a company union. There were fascist unions. Maybe we should look at those. They were corporatist unions who believed in this stuff, right? The organic unity of labor and capital. No class struggle. No. Couldn't have a general strike. Right? A real union, a real UAW, would have responded to Ratner the Rat and this guy Deese, the people that Obama put in to run the auto industry, would have responded with a general strike, a mass strike. So would the SEIU if it had been a real union. But, of course, these are not real unions anymore. These are fake unions. These are company unions. These are strike-breaking unions simply designed as means of social control. Whether the U.S. trade union movement is dead or not, open question. But right now, certainly moribund or catatonic or somehow otherwise paralyzed, not acting in any useful way. But to call that socialism is a whitewash. It is it's wonderful. It's singing tomorrows compared to what you're going to get with Obama. So right-wingers all desist from this silly propaganda that only makes Obama stronger. Notice, he loves to talk about O'Reilly and Hannity and Fox and Cheney and Bush and all these people. He's always tried in his own speeches, mentioning these people frequently, to play himself off against them. The hemorrhaging that Obama fears is on his left, and even things that do not have immediate sort of across-the-board mass appeal get him worried. Right now, Obama is worried, number one, by the fact that large elements of his base are interested in a single-payer approach to health care. Or at least, I think single payer, probably not feasible under the current circumstances, although possibly desirable, but not worth talking about. But at least the presence of a government-backed option as a choice. And I'll talk about this in another segment. A lot of people thought that Obama was going to bring them health care reform. What he forgot to see was that Obama, being a creature of Wall Street, is therefore a creature of that part of Wall Street that extends into Connecticut, to Hartford, to the traditional center of insurance, and therefore the derivatives, the insurance companies in the United States by and large have bankrupted themselves with derivative speculation, just what you'd expect, just like everybody else. AIG, bankrupt, a big insurance company. The Hartford had to be bailed out by the TARP. A couple of other large insurance companies had to be bailed out by Treasury funds under the TARP. So now you're going to have a private insurance-based system using insurance companies that are bankrupt and that are themselves living on life support with public funds going into their derivatives-destroyed coffers. Get the picture. The so-called health care reform is yet another form of the derivatives bailout. It's the derivatives bailout wearing the nurse's uniform or the doctor's white coat with the stethoscope for a stress test, no doubt, on the various insurance companies that would all fail them. So Obama is concerned about the fact that his left wing is crumbling because they can see that he's a banker's boy, because he has not delivered on any of these health care promises. And what he's talking about is cost-cutting. He's talking about gouging $600 billion out of Medicare, Medicaid, and transferring that, you guessed it, into the hands of the insurance companies, therefore Wall Street. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Obama does not care about the right-wing troglodyte attacks using slogans like free market and balance the budget. This doesn't go anywhere in a depression. You're going to go up to a worker on a bread line and say, hey, buddy, let me tell you about the joys of the free market and why you shouldn't want the nanny state to give you a bowl of soup, why you should give in your food stamps because it's socialist to get food stamps. 10% of the U.S. population already on food stamps. 10% of all mortgages now in arrears, therefore, as a perspective, facing foreclosures. Foreclosures have now passed 1 million. The Obamavilles, the new Hoovervilles, are growing. Michigan unemployment approaching 15% official, undoubtedly 25% and more unofficial and real. Therefore, depression level, 1932 to 1933 in Michigan. They say that Chrysler may restart production, but don't bet the ranch, don't hold your breath. Now, the other The other aspect on Obama is the fight between Obama and the gay community, and this is interesting. Gay community generally started off sympathetic to Hillary Clinton. That was noticeable. Obama, very, very jumpy, extremely worried about being identified with the gay community for reasons that Larry Sinclair explains in his book, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. But Obama, obviously jumpy when it comes to any identification with the gay community, because this may then point into various aspects of his own past and presumably his own current practices. So we had last week already, there's a big, we had word that a big gay community fundraiser of the Democratic National Committee was on its way to being boycotted by a number of influential organizations of the gay community. And at that point, Obama got really scared. And this shows the lesson once again is Obama fears attacks from the left as a general principle, even of this type, which is just essentially a specific group that feels that it's been treated badly. And compared to what Obama promised them, they have been treated badly. So we had a number of gay community leaders saying that they were going to boycott this Democratic National Committee fundraiser. And the importance of this is that the gay community is very wealthy. Democratic National Committee relies on this significant degree to get money. And therefore, if you offend the gay community, this had to do with the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act and other improvements that they were looking for. And it turned out then that Eric Holder at the Department of Justice, corrupt as we know him to be, had put in a brief in favor of the Defense of Marriage Act in a Supreme Court proceeding, and this, or in another federal court proceeding. This has outraged the gay community. Therefore, they say, we're not going to your DNC fundraiser. So now Obama came back with a very lame, very minimum kind of gesture, which was to extend some federal employee benefits to the same-sex partners of current federal employees. Some of this stuff is even redundant. Some of them already get it. But Obama claims that he's making it permanent can be. So there's a lot of resentment against Obama in that quarter. So what I would get out of this is the idea that a New Deal alternative to Obama has tremendous ability to undercut him, to stop him. And this is what needs to be done. The right-wing critique is, of course, primitive and impotent, based on slogans which really have nothing to do with the reality of the world that we live in. They're simply cynical demagogy pioneered by various Republicans. All kinds of Republicans use these slogans. And if you want to talk about the free market, you'll find your niche sooner or later in the Republican Party. They're big tent under Michael Steele. So what is needed is a New Deal alternative to Obama. And that, since we've passed the peak, let's look ahead a little bit. The reality under Carter was, of course, that a very significant primary challenge to Carter appeared in the form of Senator Edward Kennedy, who ran then for president in 1978, 79, and 80. Did not win, but crippled Carter enough so that Carter was not going to win the election then against Reagan in 1980. It seems to me that the most promising way to checkmate Obama is, in addition to whatever else may be done by others, whatever their ideology may be, is to see some kind of a primary challenge on an anti-banker populist program. Populism means you propose to do things for the people, not tinker with the money supply, not jiggle various institutions or whatever it is, but direct benefits to the American people, and make that then a New Deal alternative to Obama. This would be the single most important element in tying Obama down and crippling him, checkmating him for the rest of his first term, and hopefully then assisting him into his well-deserved foundation-funded retirement. So that would be the idea. Now let's look at some of these issues in a little bit more detail. First of all, as we reported last week, we have a CIA people power coup or color revolution going on in Iran. You want to know what a color revolution is? You've got to get yourself a copy of Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. We have a distinguished essay in here by Jonathan Mawat, which is the swarming adolescents carrying out acts of rebellious hysteria. And it is a study of the techniques that have now been refined of the people power coup, the color revolution, the velvet revolution. This is what's going on in Iran. U.S. interference, imperialist interference into the internal affairs of Iran is, of course, inadmissible. It's banned by the U.N. Charter. It's universally condemned as a path to war and all kinds of troubles. It's time to butt out of the internal affairs of sovereign states. The form of the government of Iran is none of your business, dear U.S. administration, dear Madam Clinton, dear Holbrook, dear whoever. It's time to butt out of all that. Haven't we learned anything from Bush that the idea that the form of government of Iraq somehow pertains to you? It does not. Or the form of government in Afghanistan, we've still got rivers of blood to go before people understand that that also is not part of their purview, does not pertain to them, none of their business in this country here, the United States. So this does not, however, depend on what Obama says. This is an institutional intervention, as usual, as we saw during the overthrow of the Shah. Remember, this also takes us back to Carter. We're back in Carter City here with Obama, as I've been warning for about a year and a half now. It was, of course, Brzezinski, Gates, Carter, Vance, Cyrus Vance, all trilateral, who overthrew the Shah of Iran. Not only did they overthrow the Shah of Iran, they made sure that the Bakhtiar civilian reasonable alternative was ruled out, and we got Khomeini, Khomeini, and nothing but Khomeini. Why? Because Brzezinski had proclaimed Islamic fundamentalism is the greatest bulwark against Soviet communism. And as Brzezinski said to Bazargan and Yazdi, we have a common enemy to your north, the Soviets. So the idea there was to use Iran as an expendable puppet against the Soviets in the same way that they did use Afghanistan as a highly expendable puppet, a kamikaze puppet against the Soviets. They've just used Georgia as a kamikaze puppet in the same direction. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Crisis Radio, your host Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. Let me remind you at this point once again, you've got to get your copy of Surviving the Cataclysm, your guide to the worst financial crisis in human history, the long-awaited second edition, the first time the book has ever been printed as a paper book, a printed book, now available from ProgressivePress.com and Amazon.com. Buy it where it's most convenient for you. This is the book that about 10 years ago correctly predicted not just that there would be a crash, but that it would be a breakdown crisis of disintegration, and even told you the causes being the deindustrialization of the United States, the immiseration of the U.S. population with a loss of one-half now to two-thirds on the standard of living, and above all then the detonator is the derivatives bubble. Derivatives, derivatives, derivatives. If you're not talking about derivatives, you are hiding the cause of the current world economic depression. Credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, structured investment vehicles, asset-backed securities, mortgage-backed securities, and so on down the line. Options futures, of course, exchange-traded derivatives, over-the-counter derivatives, designer derivatives, all equivalent to paper based on paper, side bets, bucket shop operations. All of this then growing to 1.5 quadrillion and finding this dramatic expression in the AIG hedge fund in London, which sold 3 trillion of derivatives, one little hedge fund more than the gross national product of France. And, of course, the big effort is to hide this stuff. So Obama has passed his peak. The main thing needed is a new deal or moderate left, the traditional anti-Wall Street challenge against Obama expressed in the Democratic primaries, but of course it can be expressed also outside. Now, let's remember the extreme vulnerability. Talking now about the color revolution in Iran, this is being done, of course, by institutions. It's being done by the BBC Persian service, which you don't hear because it's all done in the Farsi language. It's done by the RAND Corporation. It's done by the New America Foundation, obviously leading the charge. It's done by the various institutions of the Project Democracy in the federal government, going back to Oliver North, the various Quangos. These are these quasi-autonomous non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, and so forth. Now, the news as of today is there have been these rent-a-mobs and dupa-mobs and swarming adolescents in the streets of Tehran all week. What we see there is very interesting. It's mob rule. Mob rule. The U.S. now stands for mob rule. Any elite, anybody who's interested in law and order, right, they say, we are the U.S. and we want law and order. We want the rule of law. Rule of law. You want mob rule. The technical term, ochlocracy. We can change the name from the Democratic Party to the Ochlocratic Party, the party of mob rule. Because, of course, it was mob rule in the Democratic Party, right? Mrs. Clinton got more votes, but that didn't matter because the fervently idealistic, swarming adolescents of the Democratic Party demanded Obama. So Obama they got, and Mrs. Clinton got more votes. Those were taken away. She got more delegates, too. Those were taken away. And if a primary was not to the liking of Howard Dean, he quashed it in the name of mob rule. So forget the rule of law. This, of course, as a passing philosophical point, establishes a huge crisis of democracy, huge crisis of democracy in the world. Because if you can't count votes and have elections, then what is democracy at this point? Very, very serious problem now being created by these characters. This, really, because the whole thing is a campaign against the modern nation state. The result, if the people power coup goes through, I'll tell you what the next step will be. It will be the microstates and mini-states of Zbigniew Brzezinski in his most recent books. In other words, the Bernard Lewis plan applied to Iran means that you have a central Iranistan, but then all of the other areas are lopped off, especially the Arabistan, Ahvaz area, the Abadan refinery, the Karg Island terminal. You've got pieces taken out as Balochistan, pieces taken out as Pashtunistan. Other parts go to join Azerbaijan. Eventually, instead of one Iran, you'll have five or six, just as instead of one Pakistan, you'll have four or five. So that would be the next step, by the way. That would be Mousavi. If Mousavi comes in, rich elitist and sort of languid candidate that he is, that would be the next step. So today, big rally of the pro-Ahmadinejad forces, and interestingly, the class nature here is overwhelming. The bulwarks of Mousavi support are rich, rich northern Tehran, the rich elitists of northern Tehran, and the desperate housewives of northern Tehran who identify with the wife of Mousavi. They come in and have their demo, but this is just the rich people in the capital It's a little bit like France in the various French revolutions, right? France, 1789, Paris goes for the revolution, but the provinces do not. And there's always that story, and then that, undoubtedly that's what's happening today. You hear very little of any agitation outside of Tehran. It's simply limited to the capital. The guess that I have is that it's much narrower than the broad-based destabilization, which was essentially done through decades and decades of resentment and hatred against the Shah, fanned by the British-controlled mullahs and the British-controlled Persian service of the BBC, a branch of British intelligence. So today, I think a narrowly based color revolution, lacking a charismatic, telegenic demagogue to lead it, lacking any polling. The existing polling says that Ahmadinejad won the election because he has greater appeal among the lower classes, peasants, workers, blue-collar types, the urban plebs. Therefore, it's very likely that Ahmadinejad won the election and that this thing is in a complete hysteria of the same kinds of rich elitists that helped to put Obama into power. It's the rebellion of the liberal elitists, the people who think that they would do well under a U.S. puppet state. That seems to be what's going on there. Obviously, this does not mitigate the negative sides of the theocracy. On the other hand, the best way to let that get solved is to butt out. No interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states. It is the path to war and catastrophe. Worth remembering that the destabilization of the Shah, the coming of Khomeini, then led to hostages. It led to Desert One. And around Desert One, there are stories that make your hair stand on end about an intervention by the Soviet Air Force and others that perhaps had much more of a superpower confrontation going than is generally understood, although this remains obscured by the fact that the archives clearly are not open and Carter, Brzezinski, and so forth are not telling what went on. So Khamenei today, with a much awaited Friday prayers, Khamenei says, and we're, of course, this is the 19th of June, we're Juneteenth here in Washington, D.C., it's the anniversary of the emancipation in the District of Columbia. This entire event now seems to be drifting towards the exhaustion of the people power coup forces as Khamenei hangs tough. The critical turning point back under Carter was that the Iranian generals were convinced that they shouldn't have a military coup to take over the situation. They should leave the door wide open to Khomeini. That's where you have the current regime, which has eventually, as time goes on, a national government becomes nationalist and therefore becomes less and less acceptable to the CIA. So that's why every 10, 20, 30 years, you've got to have a coup and get rid of the existing people, even if they were your agents to begin with, because they're beginning to act more and more like nationalists as the institutions begin to shape them more than you. I would also point to the interesting story of Robert Dreyfus, who is the correspondent of The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenhoevel's man on the streets of Tehran. Robert Dreyfus wrote a book 30 years ago called Hostage to Khomeini, where he tells you correctly that Ibrahim Yazdi, the prime minister then, was a Pol Pot, trained in the same methods as the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, and that this guy Yazdi is now somebody that Dreyfus is interviewing, and Yazdi is telling him, oh, this is an outrage to democracy. We want democracy. We want Mousavi. We want to be closer to the U.S. and above all to our dear Obama. We'll be back in a minute here on World Crisis Radio.